Chapter 18. New Beginnings. I don't know what made me stop on the Colgar Bridge on my return to Wilmeringle after the holidays, my new cream Volkswagen streaked with dirt and the bonnet splattered with the baked remains of 1,000 grasshoppers. I had left Sydney in the pre-dawn to avoid traffic congestion over the Blue Mountains and raced at top speed down the western slopes and onto the rolling plains. Now, 12 uninterrupted hours later, I was a bare 2 minutes from Horvilles when I stopped. Whether I stopped for a quiet moment of reflection on the trip, or to reacquaint myself with the withering bush, or merely to note the level of the river since it had flowed generously since the day of the flash flood, I don't know. But as fate would have it, Dougie Orchard's life was spared as a result. At first, as I leaned over the railing alone with my thoughts, apart from the cawing crows, the world was quiet. Gradually, sounds of a light breeze in the tough, leathery leaves filtered into my consciousness, along with the almost inaudible babble of the river. A lonesome whipbird cracked out a whistle while flies droned close to my ears. My steady breathing seemed to stir the golden wattle sprigs, which had appeared as an early sign of spring. Sifting through these faint pages of sound came the words of a Henry Kendall poem, an unusual reflection, since the lion spoke of channels of coolness and dim gorges, which were not typical of the outback, although I had shared the poem with the children, as it was one of my favourites. The words came to me in the pidgin English used by Aboriginals, faltering and broken. It lives in the mountain, where moss sandy ledges, where moss and dem ledges, where moss and de sedges, touch with that beauty. I shook my head, but the whisper of bellbirds continued, and I looked down. A black snake was poised in the rushes, swaying mystically, its thin purple tongue hacksawing between downturned fangs. My heart stopped at the sight of the dreaded creature, which hovered close to the almost naked body of a boy laying in the mud. Dougie's matted head was unmistakable. He could have reached out and touched the snake, were both hands not clutched around the sole of his right foot. Blood soaking through his fingers dripped to his navel, and legions of flies parried for the spoils. He lay with one ear to the ground, as one would concentrate on a pulse, as though the ground was his church, and he had need to make a last confession. Drying streaks of tears reached across his cheeks. Only his lips moved. Touch with that beauty. The snake, not threatened, didn't attack. Spotting an unimpeded exit, it began expanding and contracting its scaled underbelly and soon disappeared in the coarse grass. I scrambled down the bank. Dougie's body was clammy. I spoke reassuredly as I pried open his pale fingers, expecting to find the punctured holes of a snake bite, but drawing back involuntarily as the deep penetration of a piece of glass. In trying to work whitened pieces of gristle back, he'd driven the glass inward, and a full 5 minutes lapsed before I was able to remove it. The cruel gash gushed blood over my palm. I stuffed a handkerchief against it and whispered, "Hold on, sport." I hoisted him clumsily, not surprised at the dead weight, and struggled up the embankment, talking to him urgently, hoping to reach through the mist and grab his spirit and shake it, forcing its return. By the time we reached the car, he seemed conscious of where he was. We sped by the stockyard and the large metal shed with the word Wilmeringle painted in red on the roof. Horvilles weren't home. The school had little in the way of first aid, but I drove there. Dougie managed to say, "Got blood in the new car." "It'll wash off," I reassured him, rinsing his foot with hydrogen peroxide. "Now this next one's going to hurt," I warned, and he grunted in pain as I splashed iodine into the gash. I bound the foot securely. "Looks like you'll miss your fight in a couple of weeks." "No, maybe not. I can beat that kid. One leg even. Think you beat Eddie Barker, sir?" "Oh, no idea. Don't put any money on me." "Freddie Hooper see you play that rugby, sir, telling everyone you fast like the wind." "Yeah, well, Eddie Barker runs down kangaroos, doesn't he? Grabs their tails and flips them over?" "Yes, sir. But Herb West say you a dark horse." Herb West was one funny fellow, dark horse indeed. I stood back, still marvelling that I had stopped on the bridge when I had. It was a good sign. I drove Dougie home and volunteered medical advice to his father, though I doubted he would bother taking Dougie for stitches. The injury was taken in stride, and Dougie hobbled to a petrol drum and sat with his foot elevated. My mother had put together a grab bag of clothing, and I distributed items to the children as they gathered to admire my new car. Freddie Hooper sauntered over for a closer inspection. Ben Shillingsworth, Jack O'Lantern, Herb West, and his teenage son Lonely Boy sat on a nearby log like a flock of sparrows. They were singing, "Please Help Me, I'm Fallen," and a sweeter sound I never heard. The rich blend of voices and the casually brilliant harmony accompanied by guitar and banjo playing was hard to resist. In no hurry now, I squatted on the log beside them and sang along. Ben's instrument was a simple gum leaf, which, placed against his thick lips, produced a trumpet sound. Bunny had told me that once in a parade in Bawarana, Ben had gathered together a full gum leaf band and marched down the street playing John Philip Sousa to the warmest appreciation of the crowd. I knew the children adored Ben and followed him around like a pied piper, handing him leaves and begging for lessons. When the quartet finally rested, smugly satisfied, Freddie Hooper asked, "What car do you drive, teacher?" "It's called a Volkswagen Beetle, Freddie, but don't get any ideas. It's not paid for, and you're not working on it while it's under warranty." "Bloody big beetle, boss," Ben said, and everyone chuckled. "I'd like to see the bird that chased that bugger," Herb West sniggered, nudging his son. A black and white dog sat flaying itself at Herb's feet, and he patted it with one hand and held out his weather-beaten guitar with the other. "You play something, teacher." "I wish I could, Herb." "You give me £5, you can have the guitar." "Oh, yeah, one of the strings is broken." "It make no difference. £5, give you one lesson free." "Fair dinkum?" I thought of playing a guitar was most appealing, and Herb seemed sincere about the offer. "Can you make me sound like Elvis Presley?" "I'll make you sound like Herb West, boss." "Good enough," I said, reaching for my wallet. "Here's £5." The guitar changed hands and my head filled with new dreams. Felt good to be back. The mood of the camp seemed open and accepting again. Anxiety wouldn't override emotion anyway. The black man showed a cool detachment to most things the white man did. Not that the children had been unconcerned by the allegations of Maggie Willis. Guilt had wedged in their minds and hearts. Uncomfortable with the lies, however, they had been powerless to comment. My exoneration became clearer when Bunny told me later that I would be judged no further on the falsehoods with Shirley Wallace. Her stomach ailment had been diagnosed, and no, she was not pregnant. Poor Shirley had been rushed to the Burke Hospital during the holidays and had her appendix removed. Would the evil letters from her mother cease? This disclosure left Hogan Shillingsworth as my last contentious problem, and he wasted no time showing up at Bunny's with murder on his mind. Hogan's latest jail term, 14 days for assaulting a police officer, had fueled his fury. Sergeant Jorgensen couldn't contain himself either. He wanted Hogan locked up for good. Jorgensen's pursuit was intense and perverse. He'd taken to visiting the Wilmeringle camp with extraordinary frequency, stalking the sullen Hogan and openly taunting him. "I'd like you to come to Gadooga," he'd said, standing with his legs apart and his thumbs in his braces. "Come to Gadooga and play up. Then we'll see how tough you are." But Hogan had shown remarkable restraint and was not taking the bait. Hogan came to Bunny's late on the night I returned. Cindy, the pig dog, knew better than trouble with Aboriginals during daylight hours, and the Aboriginals knew better than to trouble with Cindy at night. Anyone needing to speak with Bunny after dark stood off some distance from the store and called until Bunny healed the snarling dog. "Are you there, Mr. Horville?" Bunny called from his bed. "Shut up, Cindy! Who is it?" "Hogan Shillingsworth. What do you want?" I joined Bunny and we went to the front of the store and turned on a light. "What do you want, Hogan? It's late." "Need a lift out to Paddy O'Reilly's." "You're drunk, Hogan. Go on home. There's no way I'm driving you anywhere tonight." "I need to talk with you, boss." Bunny fiddled with something under the counter before lifting the heavy bolt on the door. Warm air flowed into the room. The tang of Gidgey present. Thunder growled far off to the east. Another change of season must have occurred. Come on over and make it quick. Hogan came out of the shadows and up the stairs, tall, dishevelled, and unsteady, and stood swaying in the centre of the room under the yellow light, his hat low, his hands thrust deep in his coat pockets. He gave me a baleful glance, then stared at the floor. I need to go, Mr. O'Reilly's. Bunny stood behind the counter. Why is that? You've been working up there lately, Hogan. I heard you did a good job. I'm going to get that, Mr. O'Reilly. Paddy's been good to you. Why would you harm him? Hogan folded and unfolded his arms and said, You robbed me. When we cashed up, kept my money. No way, Hogan. Paddy wouldn't do that. Now you get out of here and we'll talk when you're sober in the morning. Hogan suddenly flung himself at the counter and snarled in Bunny's face. Take me out, Mr. Orville. I'm going to kill him. And I'll kill you, Hogan, if you don't leave now. Unruffled, Hogan fought to keep his body supported at the counter, his eyes closed. Eventually he asked, How would you kill me, Mr. Orville? Shotgun. Hogan scratched his bristled chin and thought about that. His rheumy eyes, yellow and vain, rolled upward. The corner of his mouth curled. Wouldn't work, I reckon. Why not? I figured it out, Mr. Orville. Been shot twice, run over twice, clubbed. Suddenly, Bunny leaned over the counter and put the shotgun squarely into Hogan's forehead, saying matter-of-factly, I can't miss from here, Hogan. Now, you're either going to leave quietly on your own accord, or I'm going to blow your brains out and drag you out by the feet. If you leave, you can come back in the morning and we'll talk again. Hogan's eyes disappeared into the top of his skull, but when he found them and refocused and deliberated his options, his head bobbed my way with a look I interpreted to mean he and I still had a difference to resolve. But finally he staggered back and began scuffing to the door. Bunny escorted him, the shotgun never more than a few inches from the hat brim. He bid him good night, and a growling Cindy ushered Hogan well into the darkness. If there's anything that man's afraid of, Bunny said, holding up the shotgun, I don't know what it is. It wasn't often Bunny admitted to not knowing something. One thing I knew was I hadn't seen the last of Hogan, and I noted how Bunny extracted the shells and where he hid them.